An educational service from Principles and Policies, next. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Glad to be here again. Glad to be doing another educational service. We try to do this every time an election rolls around. We try to educate the listeners and the viewers to our website of the issues, what our opinion is of the issues, and what we think the best vote would be. Of course, we can't dictate to the listeners what that would be.
But if we could.
No, I'd really rather not have that responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Either way, I think we just educate our listeners and make sure they're informed, biblically consistent worldview voters, and everything else will work out just fine from there. Now, just as a quick disclaimer, though, Charles, we're not going to be talking about every issue that could appear on everybody with our listening range's ballot, because frankly, many of your local issues, we just don't have information on. And you should be educating yourself on the local issues that are on your ballot. You can do so by checking with your local county board of elections. They can give you the information that's been prepared on those. What we're going to be talking about today are the two statewide issues that all Ohio voters will have an opportunity to weigh in on when they go to the polls on November the 6th or on October the 2nd through November the 4th, the 3rd, I guess, on the Saturday, because they're not open that Sunday before the election. Because, you know, Ohio's voting, Charles, if I may be allowed a small tangent here for the segue, is so messed up. We right now have people going to the polls 35 days prior to the election. Now, it was one thing when the state decided to send out absentee voter request forms to everybody who was registered to vote in the state of Ohio in order to see if they would like to vote absentee. Now, I'm normally not a big fan of absentee voting for many reasons, including getting your ballot lost in the mail, but the more I think about it, the more I think that absentee voting does have at least one potential significant benefit. When the voter receives their ballot in the mail, they actually have a chance to look at the ballot and see who the candidates are in each of the races that they're going to have, and the issues, obviously, but each of the candidates specifically in all of the races that are in their local jurisdiction, from the federal down all the way down to the local county commissioners or township trustees or zoning board or sewer board people, and then they've got time, once they've seen what the actual ballot looks like, to do what we do here every day for this radio program, and that's go and search out where these people stand on issues. Because, by and large, if you're willing to spend a little time, and you're a little creative in the phrasing you use in a search engine, you can usually find information on just about anybody who's ever put themselves up to run for any kind of an office. Something's out there.
Well, yeah, we've done that before.
Oh, yes.
We've been accused of doing opposition research, and it's like, no, we're researching you, too.
That's right. Yeah, we're not just researching the opposition, we're researching everybody. So that's kind of the only reason I like absentee voting. Now, the reason why I don't personally do absentee voting, by and large, now, I can't say I've never done it, but the one reason why I don't like doing absentee voting is the election day is a civics lesson for my children. Ever since they were born, each of my children have gone to the polls with my wife and I, and actually, up into a certain point, well, nowadays you got the touch screens, and so there's really no booth to go right to anymore. But they come up with my wife and I as we cast our ballot, and they look and they see about this participatory exercise we have in this constitutional republic. It's a fantastic teaching tool for the young, and honestly, it's a great way to get them to understand that there's a lot to the responsibility of being a good citizen.
Well, absolutely, Barry, and that's something you really, really need to teach your kids, and I frankly don't like these new touchscreens for a number of reasons. I've voted on almost every different kind of machine available, a machine or device. About the only thing I haven't done is marked a paper ballot.
I've been there, done that.
When I lived in southern Indiana, I lived in a district that was so Democratic that when I went into a primary and declared Republican, they actually literally had to take a broom and sweep the cobwebs off the machine. And it was one of those old style where you flip the lever, you pulled the lever back, and the curtain closed, and then you actually flip a switch kind of thing.
Right. Right.
And then when you pushed the lever forward, the curtain came open and automatically counted your vote.
It went cha-chunk and everything.
It went cha-chunk, yeah, that's it. That was kind of fun.
And if you knew when you pushed the lever, the curtain didn't open and things didn't go cha-chunk, it didn't like how you voted, so you had to change your vote.
That's it.
Or else you weren't getting out of there that day.
I was a little outnumbered in that district anyway, so I wasn't too worried about it. I kind of went in knowing that I wasn't, my viewpoint would not prevail.
Well, there you go. You said they had to dust off the machine. In some precincts, especially in this modern age and during presidential elections, sometimes they're dusting the votes off the voters, especially those that are dead.
Yeah, well, that's usually in Chicago.
Well, I remember back, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, you're walking down memory lane with Chuck and I a little bit today. I remember back in 2004 when the marriage amendment was on the ballot, we had reports of of dead public officials who got up out of their graves to sign petitions.
That's it.
And to vote against things. Actually, no, that wasn't the marriage amendment. That was when the group was trying to get the repeal on the ballot of the adult business regulation.
That's right. And basically people were going into law offices and writing down every name
that was on the roster on the wall.
The roster on the wall on the downstairs to show the directory of which office you want to go to. And the guy wasn't even clever about it. He used the same pen and the same signature style, and he just signed the names in order.
And they all had the residence of that law firm's street address.
That's it.
And folks, these are true stories, because Chuck and I have been involved in the elections process and campaigns and candidate issues and issue campaigns. Well, I can't say that I've been involved in them for probably close to 20 years, but you got me beat by a long shot, because you were campaigning back when you were, what, 6 years old?
Well, I was in my first campaign in 1964, and I would have been seven.
7 years old,
yeah.
Your first campaign.
Believe it or not, in the old days in Ohio, you could carry a petition underage and witness a signature. And in 1968, I was 11. I carried petitions for an independent presidential candidate, and I worked all summer doing county fairs and just walking along the streets asking people to sign petitions. And we gained, oh my gosh, I think we got almost 500,000 signatures in that drive.
Well, absolutely. And you see, so ladies and gentlemen, when we talk about these issues, it isn't Johnny come lately. We've kind of been involved in the political process and the civic engagement that we have in this country and that we're grateful to have as a constitutional republic for a long time. Some of us longer than others. So when we sit and look at these issues and we review candidates, we do so with a little bit of background. Now, you know, Chuck and I think if you've listened to this program for any length of time, you understand that both Charles and I have kind of had a whirlwind tour of politics. Everything from being officers in a non-major party.
Really non-major.
Not really non-major party. To working for one of the major caucuses in the legislature.
Well, that's true. Now, you know, let's talk about this for a second. You know, we talked about this voter fraud thing. Lyndon Baines Johnson won his first Senate campaign. He got the nickname Landslide Lyndon by winning by something like 42 votes or something. And the reason he got that nickname was, first of all, the margin, and second of all, the fact that in one Texas town, everybody in that town voted in alphabetical order.
Yes.
And they all, ballots fell in there, and they all voted for Lyndon.
Yes, that's right. Everybody in the town.
Yes. So, including several dead people. So, it's not just Chicago, folks. There are a number of districts around the country where, shall we say, corruption reigns.
And has for an awfully long time. Well, but Chuck, and the point is that what we strive to do with our educational efforts here at Principles and Policies with the Institute for Principled Policy is to try to clarify what's going on out there, especially on the issues, so that voters can go to the polls with an informed ballot and not make, what we would consider to be a very bad mistake by voting in certain ways. Now, we are going to be making endorsements today, ladies and gentlemen. We are no bones about it. We're not a 501c3 organization that has to hide and not say where we stand on issues. We actually actually can do endorsements, both of candidates and of issues. And we're going to be doing some issue endorsements today. And we're going to be describing a couple things to you. There are two issues on the statewide ballot this November the 6th or October the 2nd or whatever day you decide to go vote. And I know if this is Saturday, then this is October the 6th. So if you voted on the first couple of days of early voting, in-person voting, well, I just hope you made the right decision. If you're voting after that, I hope you listen to what we have to say and make an informed decision.
There are certain things I haven't completely made a decision on, so...
There are some significant issues that I haven't made a decision on yet either, which is part of the reason why I'm probably going to bite the bullet and probably ask for an absentee ballot, at least for myself. Maybe my wife will go with the kids to the polls. I'm not sure how we're going to work that out, but I want to get some more clarity on some of these races.
Yeah.
But anyhow, you've got two statewide issues on the ballot, one of which is brought to you courtesy of 100-year-old voters, at least 100 years old voters, and actually it's more like 100, well, let me think, you have to be 18 to vote, so at least 118-year-old voters. And the other is brought to you by a coalition of groups, which we will talk about in the latter half of the program when we get to that issue. The first issue you're going to find, statewide issue, and you're going to find a lot of local, county issues, whatever, maybe on your ballot, you know, as they say, good luck with that, but, you know, just study to show yourself approved.
Right.
But state issue one, the question will be put before you on state issue one as to whether or not the voter will want the state to call for a state constitutional convention. Now, be clear on this, we're not talking about a federal con, which we've talked about on this program time and time again as being a horribly bad idea. We're talking about a constitutional convention to review and make changes to or completely throw out and rewrite Ohio's constitution. Chuck, from my position, let me explain a little bit. The reason why I'm saying this is brought to you by 118-year-old voters is the fact that it was 1912. Our Ohio was made a state in 1803. And in 1802, an initial constitution was written for the state of Ohio. Well, then, after Ohio became a state, it moved on and kept going and going, and every so often there would be an ask for a constitutional convention again when somebody didn't like how the government was being run. And that happened in 1819, then again in 1849, and in 1849 they passed the call for a constitutional convention. We got the Constitutional Convention of 1850, which gave us the Ohio Constitution of 1851, which is really the constitution by and large of what we're dealing with right now. There have been some changes made to it, and amendments and things,
sure.
but the basic framework was made back in 1851. Well, in 1871, another call came, and that one failed. And again, in 1873, that one passed. I apologize. And I'm getting this information. I want to give some credit and tip the hat to an attorney by the name of Edward Emsweller, who did research on this issue at the request of the Ohio Liberty Coalition for them their preparing of their issue endorsements, and it was shared with us by our good friend Ricky Pepin from Springfield, who's part of Institute on the Constitution, who got it from one of the liberty groups there in that area who are passing this information around. So a hat tip to everybody involved in this, but in this timeline, they saved us a lot of time, Chuck.
Yes, they did.
So basically, here we are. We just got a new Constitution in 1851. Well, in 1871, they decided they needed another convention, and then they brought forth the convention in 1873 and brought forward changes or a new constitution in 1874, which the voters rejected. They didn't like what was done in that constitutional convention. And so here we are back again, 1891, another convention and another failure, another non-passage.
Right.
Then 1910, another call for a convention. You see, like, every time somebody decided they wanted something in the Constitution, they called for a convention. This was happening about every 15 to 20 years. Well, in 1910 and 1912, the convention was finally called to order, and they proposed 42 amendments to the existing Constitution. They decided not to rewrite the entire Constitution. They just decided to amend it. But one of the provisions in this 1912 package for coming coming out of that convention was an amendment that basically said, instead of this coming up and people, you know, going out there and petitioning for a constitutional convention, how about every 20 years here in Ohio, we just put the issue before the voters and see if they want one? Because that was, they felt like that was kind of what the trend was getting. About every 20 years, a group got bent out of shape and decided they needed to change the Constitution some way. Also, some things were passed where the, you know, initiative of petitioning and referendum and things of that nature, which are more participatory democracy than they are from a constitutional Republican right. form, but that have worked out pretty well. That's what brought us things like the Ohio Marriage Amendment, but on the other side, the referendum is what brought us the repeal of Senate Bill 5, and whether you care about either one of those or not is entirely up to you, but just giving you a little bit of a taste of this. So in 1912, voters approved 34 of the 42 amendments, and they approved the amendment, which is now Article 16, Section 3 of the Ohio Constitution, that says that every 20 years, the voters have to be asked if they want another convention. Well, in 32, 52, 72, 92, every 20 years, over the last 80, voters said, no, we don't want one. Well, here we are in 2012. It's the next 20-year period, and so, by the Constitution, this had to be put on the ballot, and it is put on the ballot as State Issue 1. Now, State Issue 1 is just going to ask you that. Should we call for a state constitutional convention? And if the voters pass it in November, then in 2013 there will have to be elections for delegates to a constitutional convention. And my guess is, Charles, that that will happen in the spring, and the convention would probably happen over the summer.
Most likely.
And any proposed amendments or changes or wholesale rewrite of Ohio's existing constitution would be probably put before the voters either that November or the following year. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is the 100th anniversary of that amendment. So this is the fifth time that the voters have been asked since 1912, do you want to have a convention? Well, in that time frame, Chuck, the voters have gotten pretty smart, and they've decided that, well, you know what, we can do a lot through our elected officials because the legislature in our Constitution has a means by which they can directly bring an issue to the ballot to be added to the Constitution. So we have, that's one means of doing it. Another means of doing it is one I mentioned, is called the initiative, and that's where citizens get involved, and our provisions are spelled out in the Ohio Constitution that if a citizens group wants to get together and propose that the Constitution be amended or changed in some fashion in order to address some pressing issue or need, then they can go about collecting the signatures of other registered voters in the state of Ohio, and there's a formula for how to do that. You have to have so much percentage in so many counties in the state, etc., and it has to be, and I believe for a constitutional amendment, it has to be signatures equaling to 6% of the total votes cast in the previous
gubernatorial election.
Yeah. So, or was it 10%? No, it's 10% for constitutional amendments. So you have to have 10% for that initiative in order to get something on the Constitution. I got to thinking about the initiated statute, and that's 6%. That's another reason. You can also initiate statutory law, but we're not going to get into that because State Issue 1 isn't really about that, unless, of course, that provision would have to get changed at a constitutional convention. But basically, one of the best features of Ohio's current constitution is that process of initiative petitioning, because it has almost nullified the need for a constitutional convention. If we really find that there's something we need pressing in our society, in the way we do business, etc., we can actually go to the legislators and ask them to put it on the ballot for the constitution, or we can do it directly ourselves as a citizens' initiative, and the most famous one that our listeners would be aware of is the Ohio Marriage Amendment of 2004, which was a citizen-initiated constitutional amendment to define marriage as between one man and one woman for legal purposes in the state of Ohio, which passed overwhelmingly. So the initiative process works really well when you need it, and there are other groups that use it, and maybe sometimes we don't like some of the things that these other groups are doing with it, and we're going to talk about State Issue 2 later, because that's one that, is a result of an initiative petition. But the point is that this is what we have in place has worked very well. By and large, regardless of whether you love them, hate them, are a hardcore partisan of one party or the other, our form of government in Ohio works pretty well. Our state government, our statewide offices work okay. Our legislature works pretty well. Maybe they all don't work together at times, but they work pretty well. The voters have a say because there are 99 districts for House members and 33 districts for Senate members. Everything seems to work pretty well. And if we do run into some situations, there's always the ability to bring it to the ballot. And giving the citizens that access directly is a good idea. Now, why state issue one is what I call unnecessary confusion is, since we have these provisions that have already been written into the current Constitution, why is there a need, or why would there even be a perceived need, to call a new convention? Because, Chuck, a state convention, much similarly to a federal convention, has all of the same pitfalls that a federal convention has. And I'll let you weigh in on those.
Well, the fact is that once a convention is called, despite all the rhetoric to the contrary, the only people that are in control of a convention are the delegates, which means that the choice of delegates is everything in a constitutional convention. If the wrong set of people get into, and believe me, if this thing passes, you're going to see radicals crawling out of the woodwork in order to get chosen to be a delegate to this convention, because they will want to make very radical changes to the document. Now, the fact is that we do have something, the ratification procedure is a safeguard, as we saw in the 1912 convention and the one in the 1870s. Basically, there was a convention in 1873 and 74, and the voter said no. So you've got something of a safeguard there. But the fact is, I'm wondering if modern voters are well enough informed to be able to make the decision on these constitutional issues that come forward. Now, the fact is that you can see a number of things in the Ohio Constitution that are going to be challenged if a convention is called. There are a number of things in there, some good, some bad.
Well, I can give you a list of those, Chuck, because, again, the attorney who prepared this brief, Edward Emsweller, listed a number of things that he took from an article from the Cleveland Plain Dealer in 2006, as they were talking about a potential call for a convention. And this was an article written by Tom Suttis of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, saying the Ohio Constitution is at time for a rewrite. And these are some of the reasons why they thought it might be a good idea for a rewrite of the Constitution, our state Constitution. The first one, a creaky government designed by all male and likely all white convention runs Ohio. So here we have
it's a class warfare argument.
Class warfare argument to start with. So we kind of got a feeling of where this could go with a delegate selection, being this is some of the arguments they were saying for reason why we need a convention is there's too many white males telling us what to do.
And the con argument, though, actually is far more reason. Does Ohio need significant reform? And if so, is a constitutional convention the best way to achieve it? This is the question we continually ask when we go in to fight a new federal convention. The fact is, we've made the case over and over and over again. The problem in Ohio, the big impetus has been for a balanced budget.
Yes.
At the federal level, we keep saying the problem is not with the Constitution. The problem is with the legislators that we keep sending.
That's right.
Now, the fact is that these guys sitting in the state legislature who want a balanced budget while they're state legislators go to the federal government and suddenly start voting for all these gigantic budgets that are completely out of balance, and they spend so they can continue to buy votes from different blocks.
But you know what? You have a restriction on that in the state of Ohio because Ohio's constitution now requires that Ohio has to have budgets that balance. They can't do deficit spending. It is by our constitution. So guess what? One of the first things that might go if the state constitution is opened up in a constitutional convention, and this would be probably by acclamation of the legislators, many of whom will be sitting upon the convention delegate panel.
Oh, sure.
Would be to scrap that so that they can spend and buy their votes and do the things that they feel like doing without having the constraints of having a quote-unquote budget hole, which has been preoccupying them now for the last four budget cycles.
Well, unfortunately, I'm going to make a comment, and a lot of people may not like this, but Kasich quote-unquote balanced this budget the same way he balanced the federal budget. That is, A, he didn't, and B, he did it by basically putting off a bunch of costs till much later.
Yeah, taking things off the books and pushing it out a number of years in order to get it to come into balance now is not a really well-thought-out way of handling your budget.
It's not balanced. It's basically deferred.
Well, here are some of the other pro-arguments for a constitutional convention that came out of this article. Well, that piecemeal mail updates, that means citizen-initiated amendments, Chuck, to the Constitution don't give voters civic tools that the times demand. Now, that strikes me as code for, we want to have this thing being laid open all the time, so whenever we want to feel like monkeying with it to take power away from certain groups or to grant power to other groups to put clubs over people's heads who aren't doing what we want them to do, we want to be able to just not have to deal with the voters and go straight and tinker the Constitution.
Well, exactly. What they want is run away.
It ran away from you, I see.
Yes. Hang on. What they want is run away participational democracy.
Yes.
What they want is exactly what the Constitution was designed to prevent, and that is that things change as rapidly as public opinion changes. The Constitution is not supposed to be easy to change. It's supposed to be difficult to change because what it's designed to do is be a steady anchor on which you can tie yourself to, and it's only supposed to change when you find that there are fundamental flaws in it. It's a man-made document, so it's going to have flaws, and there are people who have done all kinds of things to try to bypass the Constitution, and in some cases they've gotten constitutional amendments passed. For instance, please explain to me why one gambling company is named in the Ohio State Constitution as the only one who's allowed to have a casino-style gambling in the state of Ohio, and the reason is because the Ohio voters basically got hit and hit and hit and hit and hit over and over and over, year after year after year, with these gambling issues, and everybody just said, okay, that's it. I don't want to hear about this anymore. Let's just pass the thing. So what happened? The lucky winner of the dice was the company that is specifically named in the Ohio Constitution. Well, is that a mistake? Oh, that's a major mistake.
Yes. But is it one that
needs a new convention to fix?
Needs a new convention to fix?
No.
No. Well, the other things that they were talking about here is reasons why we should have one, is they want to redesign the General Assembly as a one-house legislature. Well, unicameral legislatures are, we have those in Maine and Nebraska?
Only one.
There's only one in Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Right. Nebraska's the only unicameral legislature. I'm not really sure, because even Thomas Jefferson said, when they designed the federal constitution, that it was, you had the two chambers, the House and the Senate, so that the Senate acted as a cooling effect upon the passions that would be brought from that close connection to the citizenry of the House of Representatives. So in other words, passions could get inflamed locally and the representatives pass a bill, but the Senate, because they had a broader scope they had to take in, might look at it a little bit more circumspectly, with a little bit more gravity. Now, I don't necessarily believe that they have less passion than the House, but I'm not going to argue with Tom Jefferson on that.
Jefferson actually claims he got that piece of advice from George Washington.
From Washington about...
He said basically, what do you do to cool off your tea? You know, why do you pour your tea from your cup to your saucer and then back to the cup? And he said, why, to cool it and to...
Soothe it.
And he said, that's exactly why we have a two-body legislature.
So that legislation could be cooled and sued before it was passed into law.
So
an idea of a one-house legislature is only so that they don't have to be messing around with getting things through two houses. Now, for those of us who've been working on issues like personhood and the heartbeat bill and other things, it'd be great if we could just have a one-chamber legislature just to pass a bill and get done with it. But then again, what happens if, for whatever reason, that issue, because it went through so fast, like the Obamacare bill we talked about on an earlier program, is so full of flaws and pitfalls and dangers that if we'd taken time to soothe it and cool it a little bit, we'd find these things and make a much better piece of legislation that would actually meet the needs that are out there. So that's a bad idea. Other ones are to ratify amendments on school taxes. Now, I see what that is, Chuck. No local community likes to have to go back to the voters time and again to get taxes raised to provide for education. But if we put it in the Constitution, we could have a mechanism where they get automatic increases without ever having to go to the voters, and the voters would just have to pay for it.
And they got that anyway by legislative means.
Why is that important? Issues of gun ownership. I think that would be very interesting to see how that would be structured and how that vote would turn out in, shall we say, rural Appalachian areas versus large urban areas. Because I think you'd find a very significant difference of opinion on what our Constitution should look like on the issues of gun ownership and abortion.
Well, there are some other why people think this is a good idea. I don't know. Provide for appointment rather than election of the Attorney General, Secretary of State and Treasurer?
Well, then the question arises, who is the one doing the appointing?
Yeah, exactly.
Because right now the voters appoint them by voting them into office.
Yeah, exactly, and then chances are it would be the governor.
Governor, or who knows who it might be.
And maybe a legislative appointment, too, although that's kind of rare.
And then the one that really rings strong with us, require Ohio's presidential electors to vote for the candidate who gets the most popular votes in Ohio. So in other words, this is national popular vote being written into Ohio's constitution if we open it up to a convention.
Well, actually, Ohio already has the winner-take-all. What would this change?
Well, I think what they're saying
is they want to go with national popular vote.
Whoever gets the most votes nationally,
that would be
they would have to
award the votes to. I think maybe someone doesn't understand possibly what national popular vote is about. I would rather see Ohio go to a system like Nebraska and Maine have. That is, you award electoral votes piecemeal by congressional district, and then whoever wins the popular vote in the state gets to do senatorial votes.
Yeah, well, you know, Chuck, what it really gets down to is a constitutional convention, at the state level even, folks, could sacrifice many of the things that we already have in our Constitution, like the initiative process, like a bicameral legislature, like actually voters electing statewide officers, like having where we actually, when we vote for president, that those electoral votes go to the person that we voted for, not who wins California and New York.
Florida.
So these and other provisions could be sacrificed to special interest agendas of a handful of delegates. And think about it. We might have an amendment that says abortion on demand is a constitutionally protected right in Ohio, which means all of our laws protecting the unborn would be nullified because the Constitution outweighs statute. Our protections for the family, the Ohio Marriage Amendment, I know that'd be on the chopping block.
I'm sure.
You have groups out there right now trying to do it by initiative to come back and eliminate it from the Constitution. This just gives them an easy avenue to do so. And it's also, this is a redundancy, Chuck, because not only is there provisions in the Constitution for changing it, the legislature actually passed in 2011, and it's meeting now, a provision to call for the Ohio Constitutional Modernization Commission. Okay, now I'm not necessarily a huge fan of this commission, but they have a picked group of about 40 different people, and it's legislators and ex-officials and other people, and they're looking at, okay, do we need any additions or changes to Ohio's form of government and its constitution? And they are going to present their recommendations to the legislature this November. Okay? And then the legislature will vote one way or the other on which of those recommendations they believe are necessary. But then they have to bring them to the voters of Ohio to then vote as to whether or not they want to make these changes to the constitution.
Yeah.
So it's a multi-step process instead of a delegate directly to the voter type of situation with a constitutional convention. So honestly, a convention at this point in time, calling and approving a convention this November is very likely to add confusion, redundancy, and actually unnecessary expense too, because we the taxpayers have to pay for the cost of a convention.
The cost of a convention is necessarily high because you've got basically X number of delegates who have to be housed, have to be fed, have to be given access to all the information that you can imagine, which means that essentially they'll have to have a hall, probably someplace. They would go into a convention center, probably someplace.
And there'll be staff, there'll be attorneys, there'll be consultants,
sure,
there'll be researchers, because unlike our federal convention in 1787, where it was just the men in the room bringing their papers in and getting notes passed to them from outside and reading what was happening in the daily newspaper, these folks will be wired to the internet. They'll have teams of researchers, and they'll be trying to figure out, well, wait a minute, this idea of giving driver's licenses to illegal immigrants in California to help them out, that sounds like a great idea. Let's put that in our Constitution. And we're going to be talking when we come back from the break about another idea that started in California that, well, a group of folks in Ohio thought it's a great idea, so you're going to have to vote on it in November. But before we go to the break, I'm going to just say that the Institute for Principled Policy, Charles, and many other groups around the state of Ohio are urging a no vote on state issue 1,
right,
because it's unnecessary, redundant, and expensive. expensive and could be very costly to our, even to our Republican form of government.
If you put it in the scales, it's likely to bring way more problems than it's likely to solve.
That's right. So when you go to the polls in November, or when you get your absentee ballot, or you walk into your Board of Elections anytime prior to that, and you go and you see the state issues, please, we would ask you to prayerfully consider a no vote on state issue one. Now, I think, Chuck, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back here in a moment, because we need to talk about state issue two and some of its issues. And ladies and gentlemen, now we're going to be turning to state issue two, which is the second statewide issue you're going to find on your ballot. Now, state issue two is coming at you as a provision of helping to bring more fairness to the state's process of drawing the district boundaries that determine where you are as far as the seat that you would be voting on for your congressman, your state senator, and your state representative. Now, I got to do a little bit of backgrounding on this one, okay? A little bit of civics 101 for our listeners. Ohio has representative government. It's guaranteed to us by the federal constitution in Article 4, which says that each state shall have a Republican form of government. Now, this means proportional representation in Ohio, and it's based on our population, and of course, it's split up, and we have 99 House of Representatives seats in the state of Ohio. Now, this is state level, folks. Don't get it confused with your congressmen at the federal level. These are your state elected officials. So there are 99 districts, House districts in Ohio, and of that, three contiguous House districts make up a single Senate district, so there are 33 Senate districts in the state. Now, to determine the population of the state in order to figure out how many people per seat are represented, and basically the census numbers. Now, you remember the census, it came out a couple years ago. Every 10 years, we get a census to count heads and then to ask all kinds of intrusive questions, which we don't answer.
Right.
But mainly to count heads to figure out the population growth, the population waning, or the shifting of density in a region, or in the county, or in localities. And those numbers are used to help, after the census is over with, realign the political boundaries to make sure that there's proportional representation, that each seat of the 99 seats is representing roughly an equal number of citizens. That's fair. That seems to be a fair process. Now, we do that by the apportionment process in Ohio, and apportionment sounds like a big word, but basically it means that you get a panel, and this is the way we do it in Ohio. It's the governor of the state, the state auditor, the secretary of state, a legislative member of the party of the Speaker of the Ohio House. So in this cycle, the Speaker of the Ohio House is a Republican, Bill Batchelder, so a member of the Republican Party, and then a member of the minority party, and each of those two members are chosen by members of the House and Senate of their party. And so usually you have one senator and one representative, one's in the majority and one's in the minority. And they form what's called the Ohio Apportionment Board. Okay? Five members, and they are responsible for drawing the political boundaries. Okay? Now remember, it's three statewide elected officers, and so the voters have determined who those three seats are going to be. And usually what happens is, since you have a balance in those final two seats, and they're guaranteed one Republican and one Democrat, because that's basically the two parties we have in Ohio government, and that gives you a political balance, the control of which party has the influence on redrawing the lines is awarded to the party that takes two of the three statewide seats of the governor, the auditor, and the secretary of state. If you can win two out of three, if your party can put your person in two out of three of those seats in the even year, every 10 year election, so this was in 2010 election, you get control of the pen to redraw all the districts. That's just the way it works. And the Democrats have had control of it when they won the statewide. As a matter of fact, if they could have held their statewide offices
right,
in the 2010 election, they would have been controlling the pen. But since they couldn't seem to bring government to the people the way the people wanted, in 2010, many of them were brushed out of office, including the governor, the secretary of state, and the state auditor. They were all swept out of office and replaced by...
And the attorney general.
And the attorney general, who doesn't actually play a direct role in the apportionment board. But the point is, they brushed these people out of office and put in somebody else, which just happened to be Republicans. Now, so in 1971 and 1981, after those two censuses, the Democrats controlled the process because they had the seats. They had the majority. In 91 through in 2001 and in 2011, this last year, Republicans, because the voters had put in Republicans in the majority of those three statewide seats. Now, this gets us back to issue one about why proponents of a constitutional convention want to have particular seats appointed instead of elected by
correct.
The voters.
That's absolutely
so
correct.
These two tie in real closely to each other, ladies and gentlemen, although they look like they're miles apart. So basically, here you have now, and in this last drawing of the new boundaries, which happened in 2011 and was in place so that when people ran in the primaries here this spring in 2012, they were running in new seats. Now, you may have voted for the same person that you always voted for, but your district number in the House or in the Senate might have changed. You might have gone from District 17 to District 72. That didn't mean you moved across the state. That didn't mean that you were now lumped in with the, if you were living in Cincinnati, you were lumped in with people out of Youngstown for your district. It doesn't work that way because...
That's only in that one district there along the river.
Well, that's congressional, and that's the 6th congressional district, and it's a mess to start with. But the point is that it doesn't matter. The numbers change, but the people usually stay the same, is what I'm getting at. And you might have a couple of voters who, because they lived close to a line and the lines got shifted because of population shifts in other areas that they... I used to vote for, Joe Smith. I voted for Joe Smith every year for the last umpteen years, but now I can't vote for Joe Smith anymore because Jane Doe is now the person running in this district, and Joe Smith is across in the next district. I can't vote for Joe.
I can remember living in Western Licking County right after an apportionment and having both our congressman and our state rep and senator change.
Yeah, and that can happen wholesale, but you know what? The vast majority of voters... and ladies and gentlemen, I know in our audience this is not true, but for the rest of those people out there, the vast majority of voters, if you press them, couldn't tell you who their congressman, their state senator, and their state representative were. They couldn't name the people in those three offices. But these are the three offices that are impacted by the Ohio apportionment process, and this is why a coalition of special interest groups, surprisingly enough, headed by mainly leftist liberal democratic groups like the Ohio AFL-CIO, Progress Ohio, Ohio Now, all of the liberal progressive interest groups that have been out there for years, all got together and said, hey, we don't like this. We don't like the way you drew the districts because the Republicans were in control, and we're not going to, and you're drawing us out, which they're not, because you can't affect you. There are provisions and regulations about how you draw these districts that make it, and they'll say, well, they're drawing it in to protect themselves and their incumbency. Okay, yeah, that does happen, but it happened under Democrats. It happens under Republicans. It happens because this process is not perfect, but it's a lot better than the process that the group who brought State Issue 2 to the November 6th ballot is hoping you'll approve, because that process is trying to really tell the voters, well, what you said doesn't matter, and we want you to do us a favor and scrap the apportionment board and let our groups have control of the pen. And, by the way, if we get control of it, you're going to have to re-vote again in 2014 because we're going to redraw all the lines again to suit ourselves. Because we're not going to wait until the next census. We want it right now.
Right.
And honestly, it's an attempt to convince voters that giving up their current, although indirect, control over the process of drawing these political boundaries is in favor of no control at all ever is a good idea. Because if you look at this this particular provision, it would basically say that what we're going to have is, instead of your elected officials, the three statewide, being on the apportionment board, we're going to get a panel of the Ohio Court of Appeals, a panel of judges, who are going to draw from a pool, and they're going to select out, and they're going to select finalists, and they're going to pick these people to go on this board. From these applicants who meet criteria presumably developed, because it's left unsaid in issue, by the backers of issue 2.
Of course.
So the selection criteria for the people who would actually meet the standard for being one of the members of the board are going to be written by the people who want you to let them have control of the board. Now, Chuck, how is that better than the voters in 2010 going to those three statewide offices and saying, we want this party or this guy in this office?
Well, essentially what you're doing is turning over the apportionment to the courts.
Well, you're not even doing that, because all the courts can do is pick the members of the board. But once they do that, they don't have any control over what this board does, nor can these board members be removed during this cycle. Now, this thing is written so poorly that the Ohio Court of Appeals Judges Association, their professional association, has come out opposing issue 2. Okay? The folks who are supposed to be making the picks for this board have said, we don't like this. We don't want to be involved in this. This is ruining our impartiality. There's a big hint for you right there. If they think this is going to impugn their impartiality, they must understand what this board is going to look like.
Well, they understand what these far left groups are trying to do, and that is they're trying to backdoor into having their own control of the process of redistricting, meaning that progressive groups, more progressive districts will be created so that they have a larger than the say than they should have in the representative process.
Well, and the only way you can really do that, Chuck, because the current process says that there has to be compactness, contiguity, and I think they call it communities of interest, have to be taken into consideration when you draw these particular lines. I remember seeing one map that was put out there by some group that actually had house districts that stretched across two-thirds of the northern tier of the state of Ohio in a line that was about as wide as a number two pencil.
Oh, yeah. Probably a couple blocks wide.
Yeah, but it was so far across the state so that they could take in a large Democratic area across the Cuyahoga County area while still bringing in some of the rural areas in the west in order to say that they had diversity in their lot.
Well, look, the Ohio State Bar Association has also come out in opposition to this ballot issue. For much the same reason, they're arguing that having judges appoint the vet panel members would politicize the judiciary, which is exactly what the court said. It also opposes a provision that would have the Ohio Supreme Court pick the final map if the panel can't reach a decision. Currently, the High Court gets involved only if there's a legal challenge to the map.
Exactly, and then if they pick the final map and then there's a legal challenge, then where does that leave us? Because that means the Supreme Court then would have to recuse themselves completely, and you'd end up with a panel of the Court of Appeals being picked to sit over the issue.
Well, guaranteed what this group of leftists would like to see happen is have it kicked up to the U.S. federal level.
Federal level, that's exactly right. Now, Chuck, this, you know, again, this is a horrible idea. And if you, even if you're convinced yourself out there in our listening audience that, oh, maybe it's just not fair, well, let me just throw this out at you. One of the other provisions in this bill would require us, the taxpayers, to pay for everything. Now, we pay for the appointment and the compensation of the commission members, the staff, any consultants and legal counsels that they deem necessary in order to do this process. They get a blank check, because nowhere in Issue 2 does it set the salaries or the maximum amount required for a budget for this particular commission panel. All that's to be left up to the backers of Issue 2 after the voters give them what they want. That's a blank check, Chuck, on the Ohio taxpayer.
Sure it is.
And of course, it's ridiculous because, you know, when you use the term consultants, which is in the language, consultants can mean anything. Now, I'm a consultant, Chuck. I'm a lobbyist. I lobby for a special interest. But I'll guarantee you, I'd never make the vetting process of getting a sniff at this apportionment panel.
Oh, no way.
Especially with these groups setting the requirements of who are going to be members of the panel. But consultants could be anything from me, like a special interest lobbyist, to party officials. Think the head of the state or the large county Democratic parties, or the heads of major unions, and folks, the list can go on. And, you know, I'm sure I'm offending some people, but the point is that, by and large, the reason why this coalition of groups has come together in order to try to convince you to throw off these provisions, which are constitutional, by the way,
mm-hmm.
is so that they can get something that you didn't give them when you went to the polls in 2010. That was the confidence of your vote that they can make good decisions. Ohio voters voted against these special interest groups and their party standard bearers in these offices, and in every 10 years, that's part of how the process works.
Well, basically, what they're counting on is the idea that the left tends to organize better than the right does.
Oh, much better than the right does. If you are paying any attention right now to what's going on in the presidential elections, there's community organizing going on everywhere from in your local rural neighborhoods. Yes, there are probably organizing for Obama chapters even in my little rural neck of the woods, up through the African American and Latino churches called Souls to the Polls, to bring people to the polls. The left is really good at that. And what's the right doing? Well, you know, we're doing various things and encouraging voter registration, but I've not heard of a group yet that's going to be going to evangelical churches to bust their people to the polls.
Well, here's the problem, Barry, that basically the people on the right tend to be a lot more laissez-faire and libertarian thinking on these particular things, and insofar as they don't like the idea of having to organize in order to get things done. They like the idea of deciding what you're going to do as an individual, rather than coming in and creating blocks of people so that you can power your way through the political process. The people on the right don't tend to think that way. They think more in terms of, I'm going to do my thing, and if other people agree with me, fine, and if other people don't agree with me, fine. The left thinks in terms of, we're going to come in, we're going to make you listen to us, and if you won't, we're going to organize into a block, and we're going to power through, sort of like a flying wedge in the old style of playing football. You create this flying wedge, put the quarterback in the middle, and you basically head for the front line of the other side and just plow through them on your way to the goal line. These old styles of playing football. If you've ever seen those things, it ends up being a bloody mess because, first of all, they weren't wearing much, you know.
They're wearing leather helmets and not much padding.
And not much padding, yeah.
Well, Chuck, you know what? Just as we have an example from football history, we also have an example about how this process is going to work because, as I mentioned in our first half of our program, this is one of those ideas where, hey, California had such a great idea, let's copy it, because California is the only other state who has gone down this road so far with this whole idea of having a panel draw their legislative districts. And what's happened has been reported in many news sources, and they went down this road in 2010, and so they've had a year or two to get this going, and this election cycle is their election cycle for these new districts. Well, they had political operatives who lobbied the commission for their own particular special interests, which is not a surprise. They had folks choreographing testimonies, and oftentimes many of them bearing a resemblance to the truth that would be considered not identity, let's put it that way. And front groups managed by these special interests and by some of the political powers in the state, submitting maps proposing these quote-unquote so-called fair districts that really were ones that would give that one particular political party an almost unilateral control over everything.
Well, and as is to be expected, you took a system that was already politicized and politicized it to the nth degree.
That's right. It's hyper-politicization.
And you know, you can't depoliticize the thing. It just can't be done. But the fact is that what you did was you took a system that was politicized and made it far, far, far worse.
Well, and the key is, Chuck, it's the old adage, if something's not really broken, don't try to fix it. And Ohio's method of drawing, of apportionment, of drawing the districts so that we have proportional representation, although may not please everybody, it's not broken. We still have, by and large, fairly adequate representation. Now, the individuals that we elect to some of those seats...
That's a different question.
That's an entirely different question. But the whole idea of rural Ohio... in areas electing, whether they elect a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, to that particular office is up to the voters in that area. But if you then tell them that, well, you know, we're going to lump you in with some folks in Columbus, up South High Street, and you're sitting down there in rural Ross County, do you think that your representation is going to reflect your community interests? Probably not. But in this respect, you get that, and you also get the voters having, well, as I mentioned, it's indirect, but it's still some level of control, and once they're educated on the fact that every 10 years their votes for the office of governor, secretary of state, and auditor mean something more than just those people running those three offices. It means who gets to control what their districts look like so that when they go to the polls to pick the people they want running for it, they've had a say in it. With this process, their say is gone. It's going to be a special interest group that is going to be telling them what their new districts are. And if they're successful in this November the 6th, by 2014, those people who are already confused because their districts have changed and the district numbers changed are going to get confused again because this is supposed to change again by 2014.
And this will actually disenfranchise. This is supposed to, quote-unquote, re-enfranchise voters. What this will do is further disenfranchise them because a lot of people will be so confused they just won't vote.
You know, it's fairly rare, ladies and gentlemen, and Chuck, you know this, it's fairly rare when a conservative group like the Institute for Principled Policy, and I could say biblically constitutional group, and conservative in the best sense of the word, agrees with major newspapers like the Columbus Dispatch and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. But honestly, on this one, on State Issue 2, we all are in unison. The Plain Dealer has come out with editorials opposing State Issue 2. Joe Hallett of the Columbus Dispatch, in an editorial that came out just a couple weeks ago, said neither party can be trusted to enact redistricting reform. In other words, it doesn't matter. Both of them are out there saying, well, we need to change this, but we want to change it so that it's more imbalanced to our side. And
yeah,
even a paper that we disagree with stringently on many issues, we agree with them on this one.
Yeah.
State Issue 2 is a horribly bad... It's a con job, ladies and gentlemen. It's a bunch of liberal special interests who couldn't convince you to vote for their candidates in 2010, trying to convince you to give them the power to override your vote.
That's exactly
what it gets down to. So we would issue our recommendation that the voters of Ohio go and vote no on state issue two. Now, that means that we've actually said say no on issues one and issue two, and we've given you a number of reasons. Now, all this stuff's going to get posted up on our website, so you can go over to principledpolicy.com and you can look that up. And also check, we're going to try to probably put some links out there to some other organizations that are doing candidate surveys so that they can see where their candidates stand on some of these issues.
There are some candidate surveys we will be avoiding steadfastly, and other candidate surveys that we will be pointing you to because they ask the right questions, and they ask the right questions of all the candidates.
And they ask it in a very nonpartisan fashion. But there are some that don't, and so, yes, you won't. So if you question why so-and-so's candidate surveys aren't up there on our website, well, we've just given you the reason why.
That's right. There are a number of suspect ones out there. We've known some of these from working with these people for years. And some, there are other great ones that we've used over and over and over, and some of them are online. We've had people question about these online things. Yes, we understand, ladies and gentlemen, there are some of you out there who just don't like the online stuff. It's the wave of the future. We're sorry about that. These are just the facts. Newspapers are a dead letter. Printed material is just fine, but the fact is it's expensive to print. It's hard to distribute. And online, it's real simple. So that's why that's going on. Well, that being said, Barry, we're out of time for today. And I would like to invite everyone to join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.